You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's a tragedy. 27 people reported dead in Newtown, Connecticut, 26 of them in a school, another in a family home nearby. The shooter, Ryan Lanza is his name, identified 24-year-old. He shot his mother, who is a teacher in the school, and then most of the children in her classroom and a number of other people. Some high-capacity clips apparently in his handguns. So that's the latest on the news. The president's going to speak in about 15 minutes or 10 minutes, I guess, on this. But it being Friday, we, of course, our first hour is Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
This is a real tough one. I just... let me just toss it to you, sir.
Well, it is. You know, it's almost hard to put this tragedy into words that 17 or 18 children are dead is, you know, literally beyond belief. And, you know, somebody who has seven grandchildren, this, you know, is, you know, just something very hard to deal with and to think that this has happened. This happens in our country, and similar type events have happened in the past. So there's a lot to discuss about how we deal with this kind of horror show and the kind of world that people live in who can commit these kinds of crimes, and how many of them may be floating around America today, and you know what a sensible approach toward guns may be. But for the moment, at least, it's time to just be thinking about the families there in Newtown, and our hearts and prayers go out to them. This is obviously a community that is never going to recover from this tragedy. It's absolutely unthinkable.
Yeah, absolutely. There are other things as well going on in the world or in the country.
Well, there sure are, and you know. I just came back from Washington last night, and as I think most listeners know, there's a whole lot of discussion going on around the so-called fiscal cliff, and how that is resolved and the way that it is resolved will have a huge impact on many, many millions of Americans. The issue there is how we do deficit reduction, how we avoid going over this cliff, and what's the best way forward. And the way I look at it is that at a time when the gap between the very, very wealthy and everybody else is growing wider, when you have an extraordinarily unequal distribution of wealth and income in this country, while tax rates, effective tax rates for the wealthy and large corporations are quite low, that what we must not do is balance the budget in these negotiations on the backs of the elderly or the children or the sick or the poor or veterans. And I've been working very, very hard on this issue, and we're trying to fight back various proposals that Republicans and some Democrats are floating. And one of the proposals dealt with raising the age of Medicare eligibility from 65 to 67. And I think there is now growing understanding that that is a totally absurd proposal, because it will end up costing our health care system twice as much as it saves the federal government. It saves the federal government about $5.5 billion, but ends up costing about $11 billion every year, because the cost shift will take place on businesses, on states, on individuals. And I think it just doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that if you're 66 years of age and you have no health insurance, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. And I think that is a disastrous proposal. I'm very pleased that Senator Dick Durbin, who is close to the Obama administration, announced yesterday that his understanding is they have taken that issue, that proposal, off of the table, that they're not going to support in any way raising the Medicare eligibility age from 65 to 67. That's something that they had toyed around with in the past. I'm glad that they have taken it off the table. It's an absurd proposal. The issue that is on the table now that I want people to be thinking a whole lot about is something that very few people outside of the Beltway are familiar with, and that is a so-called chained CPI, which is a very underhanded and duplicitous way of cutting benefits for working families and the elderly and veterans. And what that proposal says is that the way we calculate cost of living adjustments, COLAs, is too generous. And we have to be stingier in how we do that. The result of that would be is that if you're on Social Security now and you're 65, if you're 65 and you're on Social Security, by the time you're 75, you'll lose about $560 a year in benefits and $1,000 a year in benefits by the time you're 85. If you're a disabled veteran, if you can believe it, there will be significant cuts in your benefits. And I just received a saw a very, very strong letter from the American Legion, among many other veterans organizations, who denounced this chained CPI for what it would do in terms of VA service-connected disability compensation and VA pension benefits. I hope most of us can agree that you don't balance the budget on the backs of men and women who went off to war and came home without any arms or legs. That's not the way we do it. The truth of the matter is, and this is not talked about enough, is there are ways to do deficit reduction that are fair. And the president is right in saying that we should repeal Bush's tax breaks for the wealthy. We should put a limit on some of the deductions that the wealthy can benefit from to reduce their taxes. We have to take a hard look at corporate taxation. One out of four major corporations doesn't pay a nickel in taxes, including some of the most profitable. We are losing $100 billion a year by companies that are stashing and individuals that are stashing their money in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens. We are spending too much on the military. We're spending twice as much of our GDP on the military as our allies in NATO spend, and they manage to provide health care for all of their people as a right, and in many cases, free college education. So I hope the American people get involved in this debate, that they're on the phone calling up their senators and members of the House and making it very clear that in these really tough times, when median family income has gone down very significantly for working families, many people are working two or three jobs to pay the bills. A lot of people have no jobs at all. Unemployment is far too high. That we cannot balance the budget on the backs of the middle class and working class of this country. Since Obama has been in office, our Republicans have been vigilant in protecting the wealthy and large corporations. They haven't paid one nickel more in taxes in order to help us with deficit reduction. So that whole issue of moving forward and protecting the elderly, the children, veterans, the sick is something we're working very hard on.
And protecting the sick, we have a minute to the break, Bernie. I understand in Vermont you've got a lot of these public clinics that you built into Obamacare that are dealing with issues of mental health. I'm frankly thinking about this kid who did this shooting.
No, you're right. Look, mental health issues are a huge issue in this country, and as is primary health care. I just met the other day with the Minister of Health from Denmark, and they spend significantly less per capita than we spend on health care. One of the reasons is that they have a strong primary health care system. What health care is about, Tom, is when you are sick, whether it is physical or whether it is mental, you should know that there is access to you. You can walk into somebody. You can talk to somebody. You can get the help that you need without waiting for 6 months or 3 years or paying a huge sum of money. And I think there's a huge problem in this country in regard to that.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting. We'll be taking your calls for Senator Sanders right after this, 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders. Check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Alicia, and listening to Minnesota's progressive voice, AM 950, on the line with us. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I am calling today to talk about you know, gun control ideas. I know that Democrats are never going to get, you know, guns outlawed, and I don't know that that's necessary, but I do think that it would be great if, right now we've had lots of these mass murders, and I think right now is a great time for the progressives to sort of lead with some sort of legislation that limits the number of clips in guns like we used to have, but also where we are charging anybody who sells guns, who manufactures bullets, who wants to get a gun license, to have to pay some sort of homicide prevention tax. And then that could go towards schools, putting bullet, you know, metal detectors in schools and et cetera. So that way we all have a right to live safely, and those people can keep their guns.
Well, I don't, you know, LaShawn, I don't, wouldn't be supporting a homicide prevention tax. 99.9% of the people who own guns use them safely. But I think that what happened today in Connecticut and what's happened a couple of weeks ago in Oregon, what is happening too often in this country, requires a serious conversation of how we deal with this issue. You know, what I worry about is every time one of these horrible incidents hits the front page, some other unstable human being begins to think that makes sense to do. So I do think we need a serious discussion. I think we need to deal with this issue, no question about that. So that's what I would say about that.
Veronica in Chicago, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I have a lot of respect for you. Along the same line, I've just been in tears all day about this. I called my daughter's school just to make sure the security guard was on duty there so no one could get into her school. But my question is, I know that Congress, as right-wing as it is, will never, never do anything about gun control. But do the parents of these children that have died, do they have any recourse against the gun manufacturer? Can the gun manufacturers be held accountable, and can there be any kind of consequences for the gun manufacturer? You don't make a gun magazine that can shoot 100 rounds for just everyday people.
Veronica, you raise important issues. Again, I don't know that you hold a gun manufacturer responsible for what obviously a deranged person does. The issue is, what is the best way forward to prevent these types of horrible occurrences? How do we make sure that guns do not get into the hands of people who are mentally ill? How do we make sure that people own guns which are only designed to kill people, not to be used for hunting or target practices? There's a lot to be discussed, and I think we've got to do something. We don't want to be reading about this every month. It is an issue that we're going to have to address.
Okay. Jim in Erie, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hello, Bernie. I met you when you spoke at the UE convention up in Vermont many years ago.
Okay.
The United Workers, yeah, that was back in the day. But I just wanted to tell you, you know, because I have been in this fight for progressive change in America since I was 17 years of age, even prior to going into the military, and you are doing one hell of a job on behalf of working people and our families. And I know sometimes you feel, as I did many times, joke around, you say, is the Army behind me? Let me assure you, sir, that the Army is behind you, and that we are going to do everything we can to help assist you in the upcoming new Senate that's going to be reporting in January of 2013. And God bless you for what you've done for your country, and keep up the good work. We're with you.
Jim, thank you very much for those very kind words. And the United Electrical Workers is a union that I've worked with for many, many years. They have a strong presence here in Vermont, and they're one of the best unions in America. You know, Jim, one of the frustrations that I have is sometimes people say, you know, Bernie, you're way out there. Your ideas are, you know, really way out there. They're not. I honestly believe everything that I talk about on this radio show and that people call in, we are the mainstream of America. You go out, you say to people, Do you think we should continue tax breaks for billionaires and millionaires? People say, no, we shouldn't. Do you think we should cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education? No, we shouldn't. That's what the American people believe overwhelmingly. And yet you walk inside Capitol Hill, you walk into the Congress, it is another world entirely, where people are so influenced by the big money interest and by Wall Street and by some of the big media that somehow they think it is a good idea to be cutting programs for working families who are struggling to keep their heads above water. Can you imagine people seriously? We have millionaires, Wall Street millionaires, coming into Capitol Hill. Lloyd Blankfein, among others, the head of Goldman Sachs, the guy got bailed out by the taxpayers of this country, worth hundreds of millions of bucks, comes in and says, oh, I think we should cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans programs. Who are these people? And the truth is they are a minority, but they have huge influence. So, Jim, to answer your question, I do know that the vast majority of the people are fighting for social justice in this country, that our job is to grow the middle class, the great middle class of this country. And together we have got to put backbone into the president, into Democrats, try to win some Republicans over to make sure that we do not balance this budget on the backs of the most vulnerable.
Dave in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. Only 4 seconds left? Okay, I'm sorry. I missed that time cue. Dave, I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll be right back with more. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders, taking your calls on the topics of the day and the topics of your choice. And be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. He's got a great newsletter there, the Bernie Buzz. You can sign up for it. Get an email every day. When it comes out, and the website itself is a great news resource.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And, of course, you can drop into our free live chat room over at TomHartman.com, too, where you can hang out with some of the finest minds on earth. We take care of everyone. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. And Dave in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, listening to WCPT. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Now, in light of what happened in Connecticut and watching how our lawmakers are having such a difficult time figuring out our fiscal cliff, how could we honestly expect them to sit down and at least address the issue of guns? With the outside influences that we have, how can we honestly expect this to be handled when they can't even figure out a budget?
Well, I think, Dan, if you're saying that to a significant degree the United States Congress is unable to address the major problems facing our country, whether it's the economy, whether it's the budget, whether it is health care, whether it is global warming, you make a good point. Long term, I think what we have to do is get money out of politics and the incredible abuse of lobbyists in Washington right now who have significant influence, and try to make government responsive to the needs of ordinary Americans rather than just the big money interests, who today have just extraordinary influence over the political process. But I would not be quite as pessimistic, I think, as you are. One of the untold stories of this last campaign is, A, of course, Obama did a lot better than almost anybody expected. B, Democrats and independents such as myself won 25 out of the 33 contested seats for the Senate. And C, what people really don't know is that a number of senators are coming in, new senators are coming in, who are going to be pretty progressive. You have people like Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin, one of the more progressive members of the House, who won a very tough race in Wisconsin. She's going to be in the Senate in a couple of weeks. Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts is going to do a great job fighting for the middle class. Mazie Hirono from Hawaii is going to do a good job. We got some other folks out there. So it's not just Democrats picked up two more seats, and that was improbable, but you're going to see some very strong voices. And I hope that with those voices rallying the American people, we can effectively take on the big money interest and start turning this country around. One of the things that bothers me very much, Dan, when you talk about issues, is, yeah, in my view, the deficit is a serious issue. We've got to deal with it. But you know what's even more serious is the fact that we have 23 million Americans who have either no jobs or they're underemployed, working 20 hours when they want to work 40 hours. And we need to rebuild the middle class. We need to put people back to work. We need to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. We need to transform our energy system, cut carbon emissions, and put people to work in terms of energy efficiency projects and in terms of sustainable energy. So there's a lot of work to be done, and we've got to put those people back to work.
Vera in San Diego, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thank you. Senator Sanders, thank you for everything you do. You're our hero. You're the only one that absolutely we can rely on to look out for the middle class and the American people. And what I wanted to mention is here in San Diego, California is a blue Democratic state, but the county of San Diego is very, very conservative. Yet we managed, a group of us and community organizations managed to pass a money out of politics provision in the city council that to amend where money is not speech and corporations are not people, which was for considering how conservative our area is, you know, the Duncan Hunter area. It was an accomplishment. But my question is, now that we've done this, if we can do it state by state and city by city, to what extent is that going to give us assurance that an amendment will actually be passed to not only reverse Citizens United, but to basically unequivocally assure that corporations will not be treated as persons? And
Vera, let's let the senator speak here.
Okay. Vera's made first of all, Vera, let me thank you and the good people of San Diego for the work that you've done. I can't think of a domestic issue which is of greater importance. It doesn't seem like a sexy issue, you know, because people say, well, I'm worried about healthcare, I'm worried about the economy, I'm worried about education, I'm worried about global warming. If you're worried about any of those issues and a dozen other major issues, you have to worry about what Vera was just talking about, and that is money in politics. The Citizens United decision was beyond comprehension. That's 2.5 years ago. The Supreme Court decided 5-4 that corporations were people. They had First Amendment rights to spend as much money as they want on campaigns, and we just saw the horror show of this last campaign where these guys spent huge sums of money, often without disclosure. So, Vera, I think that you and the people in San Diego have done exactly the right thing. There are now, I believe, 10 separate states, including the state of Vermont, where our legislatures have gone on record and saying we want to overturn Citizens United. As you know, to pass a constitutional amendment, we need 2/3 of the votes of the House and the Senate, and we need 3/4 of the states. So that's a pretty rough road to go through. But I think, interestingly enough, and you talk about San Diego County being conservative, I think there are a lot of conservatives who understand that there's something absurd about, you know, one family spending hundreds of millions of dollars to elect the people they want to defeat their political opponents. I think we can win this thing, and we win it exactly the way you are doing it. So there have been now dozens and dozens of communities all over this country. We have a constitutional amendment, and we're going to work very hard in Washington on this. But the way to do it is exactly the way you guys have done it in San Diego. And the issue is here not just overturning Citizens United. It is moving aggressively toward public funding of elections. We need to elect the best people to Congress and to governor's chairs and everything else, regardless of the amount of money they have. They don't have to, shouldn't have to be a millionaire to run for office and not allow corporate interest and wealthy people to push people into higher office.
Linda in Salem, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. At the end of the year, I think that the $250,000 FDIC insurance expires. I haven't heard any discussions about extending it. And if it isn't reinstated, will it automatically revert back to $100,000? also earlier heard this gentleman talk about dividends. If you make all of your money through capital gains and dividends, do you have to pay anything into Social Security or Medicare? And if you don't, why aren't we going after them?
Well, Linda, you raised, I believe the answer to your second question is no. And that is a very good point. So when we talk about saving Social Security and lifting the cap, we're talking that only on taxable income. And Linda makes a good point. Right now, I mean, it would be a huge step forward if we did what I would like to do, which is to lift the cap, start at $250,000. If you did that, you would bring in enough money to make Social Security solvent for 75 years, which is where we want to be. Linda proposes something which is even more aggressive, which I think is a good idea. Politically, it probably will not go too far. So we're staying with what we have right now, but Linda's point is a good point. In terms of the FDIC, to be honest with you, Linda, I am not aware of that. I know that we just voted on an issue for community banks. It is not my understanding that we would revert back to $100,000 insurance at the end of this year. I may be wrong on that. I honestly don't know.
John in Modesto, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Okay, thanks for the call, Tom. Hey, Bernie, yeah, you said that 45,000 Americans die every year because they don't have health insurance. I believe
yes.
Every word of it, but what I'd like to know is what's your source on that? Is it the AMA, the U.S. government?
No, it was a study done at Harvard University a few years ago.
Okay. Dan.
Let me just pick up on John. What John referred to is a statement that I have made very often, that when people don't have health insurance and they can't find a doctor when they need a doctor or they delay going to the doctor, the result is that we lose about 45,000 people a year. That was a study done at Harvard University maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And I should tell you that if the Medicare age were raised from 65 to 67, that number would go up. If our Republican friends were successful in cutting Medicaid and throwing lower-income people off of health insurance, that number would go up as well. So it is an issue we don't talk enough about. But there are thousands of people who do not get to the doctor when they should, who have problems, who go untreated, and by the time they do get to the doctor, it is too late.
And, Bernie, we just have a half a minute, 30 seconds here. The health clinics, the small health clinics around the country, how's that going that you got into?
It's going very, very well. I fought very hard as part of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, to double funding for community health centers. And in my state, we have about 17-18% of the people in Vermont access their health care. They play a very good role in dental care. Dental care is an issue we have too long neglected. Mental health counseling is part of what community health services provide, as well as low-cost prescription drugs. So it's a program we want to continue to expand, but we are making pretty good progress there.
Great. 45 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more. Senator Sanders taking your calls in just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Bernie's website, Sanders.Senate.gov.
Just give me faith, make me believe. Come on, save me, save me.
Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. And Barbara in Wayne, Michigan, listening to WDTW. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Senator Sanders and Tom. I thank you both so much for all that you do and all the information that you share with us. Senator Sanders, I have never heard the total dollar amount or the percentage that was taken when President Reagan went down on the Social Security amount. He rounded it down, and that along with the fact that for 2 years there was no COLA, and so seniors mm-hmm. lived on the same dollar amount for 3 years. That
yes.
never gets thrown in the mix in terms of the dollar amount that was lost, the percentage that was given, and that contribution, was made and has been now quite a number of years.
Barbara, thanks. That's a good question, and I'm sorry I don't have the answer, the numbers in front of me. The issue we're dealing with now, Barbara, in COLAs, as I mentioned earlier, and I know when I tell seniors in Vermont this, they all start laughing, is that there are right-wing economists and a number of Republicans, and I fear some Democrats, who think that the COLAs that we provide seniors right now are too generous. And I know all over America, if seniors hear that, they do start laughing because they understand that in the last couple of years, two out of the last 3 years, they received no COLA at all, despite the fact that prescription drugs and healthcare costs, where seniors obviously spend a whole lot of money, has gone up. I think a strong case can be made that, in fact, the COLA, how you determine inflation for seniors who are so dependent on healthcare and drugs and so forth, food, heating, has understated their inflation, not overstated it. But, Barbara, the issue that we're dealing with right now is to make sure that COLAs are not cut. The way we calculate COLAs are not cut for seniors, which between 65 and 75 would cost them $560 a year if we don't stop that.
Ken in Jones, Oklahoma. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. My question for you is, I'm disabled, and I'd really like to know what's being proposed right now for those of us that are on disability. I mean, we're living hand-to-mouth out here, and, you know, they're talking about cutting Medicare, cutting Medicaid, and throwing God knows what at Social Security.
Well, Ken,
do you have any hope?
Well, Ken, let me tell you something. That's what I've been working, if you ask me, the issue that I've been working on for the last couple of months more than any other issue is precisely that. If you're on Social Security, SSI, disability benefits, yeah, they want to cut your benefits. That's the simple truth. Now, when you turn on the TV tonight and some pundit or some politician goes forward, and John Boehner says this all the time, Republicans say it, a couple of Democrats say it, we want entitlement reform. Entitlement reform. Please understand, they don't want entitlement reform. They want to cut benefits for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And they're just talking double talk. That's what they want. So, Ken, when I talk about a thing that most people aren't familiar with, a phrase called the chained CPI, just what I mentioned to Barbara a moment ago, it means they want to reconfigure, reformulate, the COLAs that people with disabilities get, that older people get on Social Security, that veterans get who are receiving disability benefits, they want to lower those benefits. So we are fighting very, very hard to make sure that this budget is not balanced on the backs of the most vulnerable people in this country, the disabled, the elderly, the veterans, the children. That is precisely what this struggle is about. And at a time when the wealthiest people have done phenomenally well in recent years, so that you end up with the top 1% owning 42% of the wealth in America, while the bottom 60% own only 2.3%. When the last study that was done on this issue showed that 93% of all new income created in 2010 went to the top 1%, I think common sense, morality, an understanding of economics tells us you do not cut programs for people who are already hurting. It's morally unacceptable, and it is bad economics to take away money from people who desperately need it, who otherwise would spend it. So that is the struggle we're in, Ken, and I will talk to your senators in Oklahoma. And when you hear them talking about entitlement reform, that's what they're trying to do, cut benefits for people who are on disability.
Okay. Dan in Aurora, Colorado on AM 760. We have 2 minutes to the end of the hour, Dan. Quick question,
right,
please.
Thank you. Hello, Senator Sanders. I have a question as a plan to fix the fiscal cliff. The Republicans claim that it can be fixed by cutting spending, and the Democrats say that we can fix it by raising revenues. And so my question would be, why don't they take and say, we need $1 billion, cut it in half, and then both parties get to bring a bill to the floor that cannot be filibustered and cannot be voted down. And the Republicans will say, here's all the cuts we're going to put in for our half. And the Democrats will say, here's all the revenue increases we're going to put in for our half.
Let's talk it to toss it to Bernie. We just have a minute left, Dan.
Okay,
thank
you. Dan, let me just say a couple of things. I want everybody to know that already in the last 2 years, we made over $1 trillion in cuts. Okay? So we're talking about a $4 trillion package. $1 trillion in cuts have already taken place. Number two, the Republicans, to answer Dan's question, talk about revenue that they want to raise, but they haven't been very clear about where that revenue is going to come from. Is it going to come from the middle class? Number three, as I have said many times, I think that when the middle class is already suffering, when median family income is going down, you don't go after programs that people desperately need in order to survive, like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, etc. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, Dan.
Senator Sanders, Bernie, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
It is always great to have you on. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday and the latest from the shooting in Connecticut right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The news is still coming in, of course, and will be all day. In fact, probably all week, all weekend, certainly, about this horrible shooting in Connecticut. The New York Times is reporting that a gunman killed 26 people, 20 of them children. That number up from the 18 and prior to that, the 16 that we were reporting earlier. Between the ages of 5 and 10 in this morning, just a few hours ago, in Newtown, Connecticut. It was about 65 miles northeast of New York City, one of those, you know, small kind of bedroom communities, I guess. The gunman is believed to be a fellow by the name of Adam Lanza. Law enforcement official identified the shooters, Adam Lanza, L-A-N-Z-A, and his brother Ryan Lanza has been questioned. We don't have information about whether his brother was with him at that site or was someplace else. And that there's also another dead body that was found in a home nearby that was associated with Adam Lanza, with the shooter. So this is pretty grim. I mean, just imagine here you had these, you know, second, third, fourth kindergartners, first, second, third, fourth graders. This is a K through four school. Hiding in desks and closets. I mean, just terrified that they would be the next one. This is going to be a wound that these kids carry for the rest of their lives. When it was over, the children who were not shot held hands and were asked to close their eyes as they walked out of the school past the dead bodies of people and blood on the in the halls and things. This is another mass school shooting in America that we seem to be quite unique in this. The Atlantic has this interesting article by Max Fisher. This was published in July of this year, titled "A Land Without Guns: How Japan Has Virtually Eliminated Shooting Deaths." They have two shooting deaths a year on average in the country of Japan. Japan, a country that has about half the population of the United States. But but much more densely, you know, people say, oh, it's all those people jammed in together or whatever. No, much more dense. We have more school shootings than any other country in the world. Can you imagine what it would feel like? I mean, if there was even a possibility that one of those kids was one of yours or a niece or nephew, or that one of the adults killed, I mean, there were eight adults killed as well, was you know, friend, family. I want to share with you, this was published in 2004 in the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences. edition 1036. You can find it over at equalitytrust.org.uk. And it's a manuscript published by Richard Wilkinson called Why is Violence More Common Where Inequality is Greater? And it starts out, the most well-established environmental determinant of levels of violence. Now, we're talking worldwide. They did the study across countries, and there's charts and graphs here in the study that show this, across countries and across individual states in the United States. The most well-established environmental determinant of levels of violence is the scale of income differences between rich and poor. More unequal societies tend to be more violent. You know, the gun folks are out there saying guns don't kill people, people kill people. I would say, okay, guns don't kill people, inequality kills people. Why is it that the United States has this horrible problem? We are one of the most unequal countries in the world. And we didn't so much have this problem when we were less unequal. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, we were a very egalitarian society. Average CEO only made 30 times what the average worker does, which is still a hell of a lot. I mean, when you think about it, 30 times what your workers make, that's mind-boggling. Now CEOs are making 500 times what their workers make. Somebody working at McDonald's would have to work a million years to earn what their CEO is making. I mean, it's boom. Okay, in the states and provinces, again, quoting from the study, in the states and provinces, they looked at Canada as well, that are more egalitarian, the rate of homicide is low. The opposite is true for the states and provinces that are more equal. There's a similar relationship between income inequality and homicide internationally. There are now 50 or more such studies that have examined homicide rates in relation to income inequality among communities, states, and counties. And they say, a meta-analysis shows a robust relationship. So number one, the more unequal a society becomes. Now, they ask the question, why would that be? It's because trust breaks down. And this is one of the fascinating things about this cycle that the Republicans feed on. Take a state, a red state, Mississippi, Alabama, someplace in the South, where inequality is huge. You've got, some of the richest people in the world in Bentonville, Arkansas. And actually, I don't know if the Walton family is still living there or not, but they certainly were at one point in time. And you have some of the poorest people in the country. So as income inequality increases in these red states, the ability of people to trust other people starts breaking down. People become less trusting. Now, what happens when people become less trusting? They become more vulnerable to people who are selling fear. Just think about that for a minute. People become, literally as a consequence of income inequality, because of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, the people in the most unequal states and areas are more vulnerable to fear-based pitches. In other words, look out for the other guy because he's going to get you. Now, when they become more vulnerable to fear, then what happens? The Republicans step up and say, look out, those gay people are going to get you. Look out, those brown people from Mexico are going to get you. Look out, those African Americans are going to take your job. Look out, on and on. But women, they want to compete in the workplace. You can fill in the blank. I go through the Republican list. The liberals want to take away your guns. And so it actually increases people's willingness to do things like listen to hard right talk radio or watch Fox News and then believe that kind of stuff. Which and the primary message of hard right talk radio and Fox News is income inequality is a good thing. There shouldn't be taxes, high taxes on the rich. It's a good thing that we have, you know, multiple billionaires in the United States, more than any other country in the world, and that we have, you know, about a third of our country living basically in poverty or close to it. They would posit that that's a good thing. And in fact, they want to make the poor people even poorer. Do away with their Social Security, voucherize their Medicare, do away with welfare programs, end of food stamps. The Republicans last year were successful in cutting unemployment benefits from 90 weeks down to 74 weeks. All these things make people poorer. What does that do? It makes them more distrustful. As they're more distrustful, they're once again more vulnerable to messages about look out for those people. And so they vote for the people who are making them poorer. People say, what's the matter with Kansas? Why do people in red states vote for Republicans? Because they're inherently, you know, because of the inequality, they are inherently, paranoid is almost too strong a word, but they distrustful. And that leads to a whole variety of social ills, including increased rates of homicide. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do? We have a gun problem. We have an inequality problem. We have a lack of access to mental health problem. We have all of the above. This may be one of the worst mass shootings in the history of our country. And what a tragic time of year, although any time of year is a tragedy, particularly when young children. I mean, these were five-year-olds, many of these kids, elementary school kids. This young man walked in, killed his mother, who was teaching this class, and then killed the kids in the class. This is just, it's awful. Owen in Spanaway, Washington. Oh, and Owen, before you speak, I'm curious, it's going to be real interesting to see if they keep Bob Costas off the air this weekend. Owen, it's yours.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for everything you do, and I wanted to thank Senator Bernie Sanders for everything he does, in case he can still get that. Anyway, the question for him would have been this. When will there be a move in the Senate and the House to clean up with this complete mythology that's been put up about by the NRA and gun propagandists that everybody has the constitutional right to bear arms, because it's quite clear it's, you know, the people's right, a well-regulated militia to bear
that's
arms.
That's what the Second Amendment says, but that's not what the Supreme Court has said. I think it was Miller was the case where the Supreme Court said that... Go ahead.
But we have such a well-regulated militia, and that is called the National Guard.
That's right.
And it's really quite cut and dry and simple. There has to be a move by somebody to put the clamp on it and to make it quite clear that the right to bear arms is declared basically for our National Guard. That's it. And then we can start talking about what we will do to allow citizens to defend their house. But this insanity just needs to stop. And as you already pointed out, there are other countries where gun control is very successful. And actually, it's never going to stop anybody who wants to really hurt somebody else. But there are other reasons for that. And at least you can take some of the deadliness out of it.
Yeah. Let me just speak to that very quickly, Owen. There was on Fox News this morning, there was some guy going hysterical about, well, you know, in China yesterday, there was a guy who went into a school and knifed 32 kids or some number like that. And so I Googled the story. None of those kids died. And so, yeah, it's the lethality, stupid. It's at the very least, Owen, and thank you for the call. I want to get other people here and hear. At the very least, we should be looking at the assault weapons ban. Greg, I mean, this was something that George Bush even supported. Greg in Springfield, Missouri. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom, big listener, big fan. This incident happened today where these multiple killings were done because of, weapons that should obviously be regulated and or banned. And, I've got a personal story here. I'll try to keep it as short as possible, but, You know, my brother in 2008, at 18 years old, was shot in the chest and paralyzed from about the nipple line down by a fully automatic 22 pistol in Salina, Kansas. I'm originally from Wichita myself. I live in Springfield now. And in this scenario where he was paralyzed, it was one of those issues where, you know, he was about a block away from a nightclub, just walking home from a friend's house, and got hit by a stray round and was paralyzed. There's another girl. She got shot in the leg, and she was fortunately able to walk away. And it's these scenarios where, you know, these tragedies happen and these people get hit by these people that, you know, regardless of the mental health situation, which obviously is an entirely different topic, but obviously is another talking point in regards to the horrendousness of our political system. You know, this scenario where these people have access to these weapons. I'm in the military, sir, and in being in the military, I understand what it takes to kill people and the quantity of effort. And in a scenario where this person has access to this type of firepower, and I mean, in such a short period of time, I mean, it takes a time period. You've got to realize everything has to go really right and really wrong to be able to kill that many people in that short of a period of time.
Yeah.
And every time this happens, it's very horrible, and it really upsets me. I mean, obviously, as you can tell, and I mean, I just, you know, because when my brother was shot, there wasn't a lot of media attention paid to it. You know, this is an 18-year-old kid, and he had nothing to do with the issue or the situation. Was getting ready to go as a walk-on to play football at Kansas State University, of all things, if you can believe that.
Hmm.
And, I mean, there's a lot of tragedy, obviously, to my story as well as to other people's stories. And it's not really my intention so much to try and make this personal about me so much as to say this issue is continuing.
Yeah.
And there are so many models of other countries' political systems and governmental systems, excuse me, where there are incredibly reasonable laws and regulations on this type of ownership of firepower, and there's no issue. There's not this gigantic invasion every other day in these countries by other countries, these pseudo countries that are going to come over and take over our countries, et cetera, et cetera. And I have to admit, you know, you get to a point, Tom, where you're just kind of like, where's the solution here?
Right. Yeah. First of all, I mean, let's keep in mind that actually somebody sent me a note on this that was just, you know, brilliant. He said, at the time of the Constitution, this was Vince, he says, at the time of the Constitution, the United States was drafted and ratified. The state of the art in assault weapons was a very heavy muzzle loader rifle made of solid iron, trimmed in hard wood, no bullets as we know them today. To fire the gun, the frontiersman had to pour a measured load of gunpowder down the barrel. Then he had to push a rod all the way down the barrel to tamp the powder firmly to the bottom. He then had to push an iron ball into the barrel and tamp it down till it fits snugly in the powder nest he had just created for it. After that, he had to pour more powder into the flintlock mechanism to completely activate the weapon. If the flint produced a spark and the powder he used was dry, and he did a good job when he packed the barrel, he could get off one shot. If a colonial madman had walked into a colonial McDonald's or a colonial kindergarten classroom determined to kill innocent children, he could have gotten off one shot for sure, and that's it. I mean, you know, and so if our founders intended that we all have guns, I mean, it was in that context. I don't think that they would recognize these high capacity clips.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the idea that military armament, basically, you know, high capacity magazines that are designed for killing people would just be, you know, easily available. That's crazy. Good time call. I see. Okay. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. This is what the President of the United States had to say this afternoon.
I'm in grief that I do. The majority of those who died today were children. Beautiful little kids between the ages of 5 and 10 years old.
At this point, he wipes a tear from his eye.
They had their entire lives ahead of them. Birthdays, graduations, weddings, kids of their own. Among the fallen were also teachers, men and women who devoted their lives to helping our children fulfill their dreams. So our hearts are broken today for the parents and grandparents, sisters and brothers of these little children, and for the families of the adults who were lost.
That was the President of the United States just about an hour ago. Blake in Gadsden, Alabama. Hey, Blake. Thanks for listening to TuneIn Radio. What's up?
Hi, Tom. First-time listener. First-time caller, long-time listener. I sure do appreciate everything that you do. I listen to you quite often, find you to be quite brilliant. Just like everyone else, I find you to be quite brilliant.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was joking. I said, but usually people say that, and then they go, but you're so wrong about this. Okay. Yeah. You wanted to talk about gun regulations.
No, there's not going to be that type of call today.
Yeah.
I just sort of want to put my comment out there to make people aware that most of these mass shootings actually occur in gun-free zones, places that are banned already. Now, I am not against gun regulation. I believe that assault weapons and especially true automatic rifles need to be taken off the market completely. But I also
are you trying to suggest to me, Blake, that if that kindergarten teacher had had a pistol in her drawer when he walked in and pointed the gun at her head, that somehow she could have done a Rambo?
No, absolutely not. I don't think that's the case.
How would you put guns in the school in a way that kids aren't going to get their hands on them or that they're going to be useless? I mean, just think about it. You've got a determined killer, a heavily armed determined killer coming in. Whether there are guns in that school or not, he's going to kill people.
Not as many people if there was a person there.
So you want every school in America to have an armed guard?
Possibly. First of all, Tom, I don't think there's a solution to this problem.
Well, I think there is. Let me just ask you a really simple question, Blake. You know, if you look at the ancestry of Americans, you know, we're kind of a melting pot country here, but we can identify the places that we all come from. And I don't see, you know, school shootings on a large scale happening in Mexico. I don't see shootings on a large scale happening in Europe. I don't see shootings on a large scale happening in the developed parts of Africa. In my opinion, this has to do with the fact that the United States is becoming a third world nation. We have more income inequality in this country, which directly correlates with both homicide and mental illness. We have more income inequality, worse income inequality in this country than virtually any other country, developed country on earth. I mean, we're up there with Zimbabwe. And it's a consequence of Reagan's tax cut policies and his allowing corporations to consolidate and letting billionaires become billionaires and his war on labor. And when you have a situation like that, I mean, just do you remember any mass school shootings in the 1950s or 60s or 70s or even the 80s?
I'm sure that there was a few, but no, I do not remember them.
Yeah, I don't either. And I think if there were any at all, we would remember them. And yet now, you know, in the last decade, we can name them. And, there was Columbine and there was this and that. And, I think that what we have is a cultural and societal problem. And I think at its foundation, it has to do with people not trusting each other. And people who need access to mental health treatment not having access to that treatment. And that has to do with our not having a national health care system and our having an incredibly unequal society. And you can put all the guns you want in the schools. I mean, the last time I was down in Bogota, Colombia, you've got armed guards everywhere. Go ahead.
Sorry. I'm not suggesting that anything that you said, I actually agree with everything that you just said. I am a liberal. I am a gun owner. I myself have never been in any incident. I'm just trying to state the simple fact that 99.9% of gun owners are not criminals, and they do not have mental disability.
I don't disagree with you, and I'm not saying that the solution to this is to get rid of the guns. I do think that bringing back the assault weapon ban makes sense. If somebody wants to own a military-style, you know, high-capacity either device or clip, then let them be in the military, or let them go to a shooting range and rent it, or use it under very, very narrowly defined circumstances. But this,
I,
you know, this,
I
this.
Agree.
You know, walking into a school with a couple of 9mm pistols with 15 round clips in them, that's not something you use for hunting, and it's not something you use for self defense. That's something you use for killing human beings.
First on that, we're not sure what type of guns were used. From what I understand, it was handguns.
Right, with high capacity clips, just like Jared, what's his name, who shot Gabby Giffords.
Correct, and you know, again, I'm just trying to point out that all of these mass shootings take place in gun-free zones.
No, they don't. They don't. Gabby Giffords and eight other people were shot. Eight or nine people were killed in the parking lot of a supermarket. It's not a gun-free zone. Blake, I'm sorry, your logic is breaking down. And by the way, the Michigan legislature just voted yesterday or the day before, the wonderful Republicans in the Michigan legislature, to allow guns in schools. Like, as in, you can carry a gun into a school. Insane. Mark, it is absolutely insane. Mark Taylor, Canfield in Seattle. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. I've been reporting for Free Speech Radio News on the Pacifica Radio Network about this federal grand jury investigation of activists in Seattle and also on the legalization of marijuana and our new gay marriage law. But I just want to say, you know, my heart goes out to the folks in Connecticut, and that's the kind of story that makes a reporter kind of, you know, sort of takes your breath away because it's hard to.
I absolutely agree. Do you have something that you wanted to a point that you wanted to make, Mark?
Yeah, just a quick comment to put that in context. If you go to Vision of Humanity's website, you'll find that the United States is 88th out of 158 countries in the world on the Global Peace Index, which means there are at least 87 other countries where it's actually safer to live, but. What's happening in Seattle is, one, the Justice Department hasn't done what our own King County prosecutor thought they would do, so there hasn't been an injunction against our legalization of marijuana law. Two, thousands of people are getting married on a daily basis because of the same-sex law. But there's a grand jury, federal grand jury in Seattle that's been happening since August, and today there's a rally and vigil at the federal courthouse in support of three of the activists. There have been four people actually who've received subpoenas in this investigation of Northwest activists, but three of them, two of them are already in jail. They've been in jail for several months, and it looks like a third one is probably scheduled to be jailed today. His name's Maddie Pfeiffer, and he's from Portland.
And they're being jailed for what, Mark?
Contempt, because the activists are refusing to testify at the grand jury.
These are Occupy activists?
Well, not necessarily, although I guess a couple of them in Seattle actually had been involved with some.
They're refusing to testify about what?
Protests. It's hard to say, Tom, because it's a secret grand jury. You know, all of the subpoenas and warrants have been sealed.
Yeah.
But it looks like it's an investigation into the anarchist movement in the Northwest. And the National Lawyers Guild and the resistors and their support groups are saying that it's a witch hunt. It's a political witch hunt. So. They're refusing to testify, and because of that, they're being jailed in
Okay, so people can check this out at the Seattle courthouse right now, right?
Yeah, it's happening right now, and there's also a support website at WordPress called No Political Repression that gives statements about the activists who've been subpoenaed and jailed.
Okay, great. Mark, thank you very much for that call. Steve in Gilderland, New York. Hey, Steve.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call, Tom. You've been talking about inequality.
Yeah.
Leading to violence, and I just wanted to encourage you and everybody else to Google monkeys paid unequally.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find a video there about research that's being done, not just with monkeys, but apparently with other species as well. And quite quickly, when two monkeys next to one another are paid unequally, it leads to violent reaction.
To conflict, yeah. They've done these studies with little kids, too. And of course, you know, with big kids, with adults, you can see it writ large. It's class warfare, class struggle, you know, all these things. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And I've seen reference a couple of times to that monkey study. What would you Google again?
Monkeys paid unequally.
Monkeys paid unequal.
Okay. I think the YouTube video might be a clip from a TED Talk or something like that.
Ah, okay. I'll have to fire up DuckDuckGo.com and check that out. It sounds interesting. Steve, thank you for the call. And this is, I think, not to point to this shooting, but it's sort of like, you know, okay, did global warming cause Hurricane Sandy? Yes and no. And did inequality and the availability of high-capacity clips cause this shooting? Well, yes and no. And will Bob Costas be on TV this weekend? Maybe not.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I know. He'll be showing up with duct tape over his mouth. 45 minutes past the hour.
Every time I read the news, I'm always more confused.
Well, maybe Victoria Jones can unconfuse us. The Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat in the purse and the former slave that you actually helped at GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Victoria Jones. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So, sad news out of Connecticut, and the president has spoken on this. Is this going to produce any kind of, well, I'm curious, you give us the update.
Well, the president spoke around 3:15 from the Brady Press briefing room on the shooting in Connecticut, visibly moved, at times unable to go on. I've never seen the president like this. I've covered him for the last 4 years. I've seen him moved by very emotional events. I saw him very moved in Aurora. I saw him very moved with other mass shootings. I've never seen him like this. At one point in the middle, he wiped away a tear. I think he cried at another point. I didn't know that he was going to make it through. Most of the time, he spoke of the emotion. There were a couple of policy points. He said, we've endured too many of these tragedies in the past few years. He also said that he'd spoken with Governor Malloy, FBI Director Mueller, saying that they would get every resource they needed. Then he said, as a country, we've been through this too many times, whether it's an elementary school in Newtown or a shopping mall in Oregon or a temple in Wisconsin, a movie theater in Aurora or a street corner in Chicago. These neighborhoods are our neighborhoods and these children are our children. And we're going to have to come together and take meaningful action to prevent more tragedies like this, regardless of the politics. He did not say what that meant.
Right. Although I guarantee you what the whole right-wing radio and TV sphere is buzzing about is Obama just said he's going to take your gun.
And he did not say that. And yeah. He addressed gun control only about 3 times during the campaign and was pretty mild on it. He also today said that the flags would be flown at half staff everywhere until December the 18th.
Yeah, we have a shot of the Capitol we go to during breaks, and I noticed that the flags were at half staff on the Capitol building, right? In fact, there's the shot right now.
Now, Jay Carney, the White House press secretary, who held his briefing before the president spoke, said repeatedly when he was being asked questions about this and about gun control, kept saying repeatedly that today's not the day for that discussion. That there will be a day for that discussion, but today is not the day for that discussion. I don't know whether you saw The Daily Show a few days ago where Jon Stewart did a riff on when is the day for that discussion.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I've seen it references
very,
to it.
It was apparently very on point about when is the day for that discussion. But it's interesting because clearly the president decided that today is the day for a discussion of something.
Mm-hmm.
For the beginning of a conversation. Also,
I'm guessing, by the way, what it is the assault weapons ban, because that was passed with bipartisan support. It lasted through both Democratic and Republican administrations. It was allowed to lapse during the Bush administration. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it was not something that the Bush administration tried to take out.
Right. And it's something that Ronald Reagan supported in 1994.
Right.
Also, the suspect in the Connecticut school shootings is Adam Lanza, age 20. The older brother, Ryan, 24, of Hoboken, New Jersey, is being questioned by police. Adam Lanza, age 20, is dead. Ryan Lanza, who was previously identified as the shooter, is not the shooter.
Right, and is not dead.
And is not dead. The names were transposed mistakenly by a law enforcement official. So it's just, I think, important for people to know. There are always things that get mixed up early in these stories, and that's a big one, but there are always things that get mixed up. So the numbers of dead and wounded could also change.
I understand this kid was dressed in military-style garb and was carrying 9mm handguns with high-capacity clips. Is that confirmed?
He had a Glock, a Sig Sauer, and a .223 caliber rifle. I only know of the three guns.
Okay.
I tell you, only know, but I had originally heard four, which is why I inserted the word only.
Yeah. Okay.
Difficult to follow that, really.
Yeah.
But I will follow it with Syria.
Okay.
Because Western intelligence agencies observed Syrian trucks making advanced preparations for the potential use of chemical weapons last week, including loading trucks with ready-to-use bombs and shells. And that's what prompted President Obama to warn Syria against using them. They were quite far on. At least one army unit began loading special military vehicles that transport bombs and artillery shells carrying chemical warheads.
Yikes.
And it's not known who gave the order, whether it was senior Syrian leaders, possibly including President Assad, or whether it was some random military commander in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a cause of grave concern. I asked Jay Carney today whether there was a red line at the use of chemical weapons, or wasn't that a bit too late? And I didn't get a very satisfactory answer, being told basically that it seemed that my impression was that there were two red lines, that there was a red line on the movement of chemical weapons and a red line on the use of chemical weapons, which actually didn't make sense to me.
Well, they're trying to avoid intervention in Syria as very, very much as they can.
Indeed.
You know, and so that line may be moving around.
Indeed. Also today, the president, in an interview with Barbara Walters, which will air tonight, says that the enforcement of the new marijuana laws in Colorado and Washington is not a top priority of federal law enforcement. We've got bigger fish to fry.
Mm.
It would not make sense for us to see a top priority as going after recreational users in states that have determined that it's legal, he said.
Hmm. Remarkable. Victoria Jones. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com. We're going to get back to Anything Goes Friday here. Your thoughts, my thoughts, and everything in between on what's happening in this country with this bizarre gun culture.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So ours, Zach Bocamp, reporting over Think Progress Justice. Hours after the terrible shooting in Newtown, Connecticut elementary school, the Michigan House Republicans issued a demand that Governor Rick Snyder sign a bill, which they had passed earlier in the week, that would make it easier for people to receive a gun permit and open up gun-free zones, including schools, to guns. Right. Strict gun control laws, they said, do not stop criminals from committing evil acts. They merely infringe on the rights of law-abiding citizens who might be able to take action against evil if given the chance. This is, of course, the meme. Now, this is the second mass shooting this week. The rate at which Aviva Shen, blogging over at Think Progress Justice, the rate at which people are killed by guns in the United States is 19.5 times higher than similar high-income countries in the rest of the world. That's 1,900%. It's not 100% higher. It's not twice. It's not 200% higher. It's not, you know, twice as high. It's not five times as high. It's not 10 times as high. It's almost 20 times as high. And then they give a list. And by the way, just this really, in the last 30 years, since 1982, we've had 61 mass murders. And if you look at the track from the 80s, from 82 until today, they're getting more frequent. It is a truly, I mean, just from Columbine, okay, that was April 20th, 99. And July 29th in 99, there was another mass murder. I won't go through the details of each one. Mark Oren Barton, 44, murdered his wife and two children with a hammer before going after a day trader. Killed 12 people, including his family, and injured 13 before killing himself. September 15th, 1999, there was another one. July 8th, 2003, there was another one. March 5th, 2005, another one. And now we are full blown in the Bush years as the bubble is bursting, as inequality is skyrocketing as a result of the Bush tax cuts on top of the Reagan tax cuts. March 12th, 2005, March 21st, 2005, March 25th, 2006, October 2nd, 2006, February 12th, 2007, April 16th, 2007, December 5th, 2007, February 7th, 2008, February 14th, 2008, March 29th, 2009, April 3rd, 2009, November 5th, 2009, August 3rd, 2010, January 8th, 2011, that was Gabby Giffords. Six people died. September 6th, 2011, October 14th, 2011, April 2nd, 2012, April 6th, 2012, May 29th, 2012, July 20th, 2012, August 5th, 2012, September 27th, 2012, December 11th, 2012, that was the shooter in Portland, and now this in Connecticut. Now, I'm not saying that there's any, you know, easy, oh, we can point to this as the cause and we can point to this as the solution. Certainly, easy access to firearms makes it easier for people to do everything from suicide to homicide. And in many cases, these mass murders are just, you know, suicide where the guy is taking out a bunch of people with him. And it's almost always men. So easy access to weapons, I would say, you know, plays a contributing factor here, particularly weapons that have high capacity clips that you know, where you can get off a lot of shots really quickly. But the one thing that you're going to hear no discussion of, I guarantee it, watch your corporate media tonight, you will hear no discussion of the simple graph that you can see over at equalitytrust.org.uk. The work of Richard Wilkerson and Kate Pickett, as I recall. This just straightforward stuff that when you look at all these countries in the world and you see where is inequality the greatest, that's where you have violence at the greatest, homicides. And where is inequality the least? In other words, where is there more equality? There is less violence. More equality, less violence. Less equality, more violence. It's an absolutely linear relationship. On the graph, they draw a line through it. And one of the most equal countries, unequal countries in the world, us, we have the least equality in the developed world. We have the most violence. And if you look at our individual states, they've got the graphs on those too. And you graph the 50 states of the United States, and you find that the most unequal states have the highest violence. Less equality, more violence. And that's pretty much the only correlation. There's not a correlation. And Richard Wilkerson goes through this, you know, detailed. I mean, just It's a 25-page long, painfully detailed analysis of this. I mean, looking at things like, you know, is it men, women? Well, the ratio of men killing to women killing is pretty much the same here as it is anywhere else in the world. So it's not that we've got more crazy men. Is it the number of firearms? Well, no, there are countries where there's lots of firearms, and there's countries where there's very few firearms. And there doesn't seem to be a huge correlation between, you know, mass events like this or homicide in general and that. But inequality is the one thing that jumps out. In fact, you can tie inequality to teen pregnancies, to obesity, to mental illness. I think, wait a minute, what does this have to do with mental illness? It's a driver. It absolutely is. It's not genetically ordained necessarily to mental illness, to physical illnesses, to heart disease, to crime, to homicide. I mean, it's right there. The statistics are impossible to ignore. In my opinion, this is why we lead the world in school shootings. It's why we lead the world in homicides. Why you're 19 times more likely to be the victim of or perpetrator of a mass killing in the United States than in any of the countries that have the relatively same income as we do. It's because people don't trust each other. This is the corrosive thing that Wilkinson and Pickens talk about. He says, you know, what is this? He says, the relationship between violence and inequality appears to be part of a more general tendency for the quality of social relationships to be less good in more unequal societies. As well as more violence, people in more unequal societies tend to trust each other less and are less likely to be involved in community life. There are lower levels of social capital. Hostility levels are higher. And there's almost certainly more discrimination against minorities and women. And then he goes to de Tocqueville, you know, who wrote Democracy in America back in 1836, which was a time when America was very egalitarian. We had no billionaires in today's dollars back then. I mean, it was the most equal, among the most equal times in the history of this country. He says, in the past, many people as far back as de Tocqueville and earlier have regarded inequality as divisive. Or is that divisive? And socially corrosive. We now have data that confirm their intuitions. More equal states. The more equal states in the United States, the states where equality is fairly high, inequality is fairly low, only 10 to 15% of the population agree that they can't trust other people. In the more unequal states in the United States, 35 to 40% of people say they can't trust each other. And out of that comes pretty much everything else.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But it's Anything Goes Friday, so I'll let you get your say in here when we come back from the break. 15 minutes past the hour.
Anything goes. Yeah. Anything goes Friday.
Dick in Billings, Montana. Hey, Dick. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Fine.
You know, the National Guard and the Second Amendment.
The National Guard and the Second Amendment, okay.
Yep. Why don't we change the name of the National Guard to the National Militia?
Mm-hmm.
And then when kids turn 18, also re-implement the draft.
Yep.
Well, let's put everybody in the militia so they have the right to bear arms.
I don't disagree with you. It's very clear to me from reading the founding documents of this country that most all of the people who pushed to have that Second Amendment in there were doing so because they didn't want a standing army on our soil during times of peace, and they instead wanted a volunteer militia with what do you call them, armories where the weapons would be held and
sure.
You know, under local control, well regulated.
Yeah, I remember, you know, being a kid back in Pennsylvania growing up. There was an armory. This was in a little town called Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. And there was this armory where the national, where they kept all, that's where they kept all their weapons. They kept their rifles. They were all the weekend warriors, blah, blah, blah. And I guess, so anyway, if you had them, if you were able to get around the argument of the crazy NRA guys and the greedy corporatists and re-implement the draft, I think would do two things, Tom. I think that stops Iraq's from happening again, because all the rich guys won't let their kids go.
Yeah, well, and the, one of the things that the draft does is it creates a more egalitarian society again, it, particularly when it's implemented well. I mean, during the Civil War, people could buy their kids out. They could hire people to stand in for their children. We don't want that. But I'm with you. This is something that Charlie Rangel and I have talked about a number of times. He wants to bring back the draft. I think that we should bring back the draft. And I think that if we had a national draft, we never would have invaded Afghanistan. We never would have invaded Iraq. We wouldn't have a terrorism problem right now. Frankly, we probably wouldn't have gone into Kuwait back in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, which is what led to 9/11, because we put then, you know, Prince bin Sultan, whatever it is, air base in Saudi Arabia. And that was the thing that PO'd bin Laden so much that he decided to take us out. And you know, I just don't think that the American people would have put up with any of it if we had a national, you know, if we had a national draft and members of Congress's kids were in the military and everybody's kids were in the military. So I'm with you, Dick. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Richard in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Richard, anything goes. Your topic.
My topic is your discussion yesterday of what are we going to do with all these high-level radioactive wastes and how can we do anything that will last for 100,000 years?
Or a million.
And if you do the other route and use the safe nuclear reactors, the ones that don't have water in them, because the problem is that if you overheat a nuclear reactor with a bunch of water in it, the water turns into steam and occupies 600 times as much volume.
Right.
So you need this huge containment vessel. But if you've got a molten salt reactor, it can actually run hotter. And you don't have that problem. And it naturally controls its own overheating.
Yeah. Respectfully, Richard, you know, uranium and its associated, I think they're called actinides, that level, that bottom level of the periodic table. These are naturally occurring elements that are very, very rare in our Earth's crust. And rarely do people encounter them other than possibly radon from the breakdown of granite, you know, of uranium and granite. And we should leave them there. I think it's a bad idea to be concentrating things that are so heavily toxic when we have, you know, there's more sunlight falling on the United States in an hour than we could use for power for a year. When we've got wind, you know, all across the United States, we've got wave power, we've got all kinds of alternatives.
Problem is, but what we're talking about was the problem of getting rid of the high-level waste, and that's what you can put into these molten salt reactors and burn it up.
Right. Okay. Well, you know, if that was the only way or the best way to get rid of the radioactive waste, I probably wouldn't be hysterically opposed to it. You know, this is one of the problems. It's like, how do you make the best of a bad situation? So, Richard, thank you for the call. Jay in Houston, Texas. Hey, Jay.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. You wanted to talk about human nature and equality.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of get your opinion because I'm a little bit, I fall somewhere in between the middle of the left and the right. And so my question kind of is to what you would say that whenever people are striving so hard to make these strides to equalize everybody, where they pin the CEO of a company or the the guy on top as the bad guy because they're making all this money and they're rich and they're successful, therefore they are the man, or any of these other situations that you can relate that scenario to where they're trying to make everyone equal. And it's not in human nature to do that.
I think you're wrong,
doctor.
Jay. I absolutely believe that you're wrong. If you look at read some good anthropology, that you look at indigenous and aboriginal cultures that have been around for thousands of years and figured out sustainable ways to live on the earth, without exception, or by and large without exception, they are very, very equal. The chief, in fact, very often is the least wealthy among the group. I would submit to you that
of the fact that they don't have any drivers. I mean, wouldn't you agree that if you have no drivers, I mean, for example, I mean, I studied a lot of anthropology in my undergrad, and, you know, those same tribes would be the ones that will whack each other with sticks for dominance or take women for whatever. So, you know, they've got their own weird things going on, but yeah, you draw those conclusions.
Sometimes in some places, but typically, if you look at human societies, you look at primate societies, I believe that we're hardwired for egalitarianism, not for greed. I believe that when you see people accumulating massive amounts of wealth, that's a mental illness, a cultural and personal.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's a form of obsessive compulsive disorder where the object of their obsession and the trigger for their compulsion is not getting their hands dirty and washing them, but getting money.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything goes Friday, although there is, you know, kind of this elephant in the room, which is this mass shooting and the long, long line of them in American history. Diane in Seattle. Hey, Diane, thanks for listening to Talk 1090. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm sorry. Eating something. I was on hold.
All right. I know it's all of us here on hold for, you know, 20, 30 minutes, and all of a sudden, hello! You know, it can be a shock.
I know. yes, it has been a very sad and somber day, but it has also been a day of revisiting some very emotional and poignant topics regarding the whole gun issue. I appreciate your perspective on the inequality part of that. I hadn't really given that a lot of thought, but it was definitely thought-provoking, and I will spend some time digesting that. However, my call is regarding, I guess, a wild idea that I had regarding the Second Amendment. As you so eloquently, or maybe your caller described the weapons of the day that amendment was written.
Yeah, yes, somebody sent me a note on this.
Yeah, okay. So if for the people who are diehards that we cannot alter, amend, change the Second Amendment to keep up with today's times and today's world and today's weapons, if they want to keep it exactly as written, then the right to bear arms should be the arms of the day that was written. So anybody who wants one of those muzzle-loading guns that you described can have them.
Yeah.
But everything else is off the table.
Well, this is what Vince in Traverse City writes about. He says, if a colonial madman strolled into a colonial McDonald's or a colonial kindergarten classroom determined to kill innocent children, he could get off one shot for sure. If he'd have preloaded a flintlock pistol and had it tucked in his belt, he might be able to squeeze off a second shot before an angry mob dragged him into the street and lynched him from a very tall tree. The high-performance killing machines we know today weren't even imagined in the 1700s.
Right. So to appease the dyed in the wool, we're not going to change the Second Amendment at all to keep up with the times. Let's all just go, okay, fine. Yeah. Then the guns that it's, or the arms that it's referring to are those guns, and you are protected for those guns, not for the guns that we have today, and just tell everybody to shut up. I mean, you know.
You may have all the muzzle loaders you want.
Right. Keep them all, yep, because you're right. If they could hit a, you know, broadside of a barn, they'd be lucky, and you're right, they wouldn't even be able to reload a second time. But they're, you know, the people who do not want to look at the Constitution as a living, breathing document that was originally written as a framework to expand as our world and our, you know, our country expanded and changed, if they want to hold, you know, steadfast to the times of 1776 or 5 or whatever, then let's just go back to those weapons and let them have all the muzzle loaders they want.
Yep. It was 1789, just a point of But yeah, when the Constitution was ratified, and I think it was maybe even 1791 when the Bill of Rights was attached to it. But still, it was the 1700s, and you're absolutely right. And Diane, that's a great call to action. Let us say people have an absolute right to own muzzle loaders, flintlock rifles, and anything else is regulated by the government in a way that makes common sense. Diane, thank you for the call. Dan in Morocco, Indiana. Morocco, Indiana. Hey, Dan. Says you disagree with me on gun control. I don't know that you know my position on gun control if you're disagreeing with it.
No, I've been listening to your program here recently, and I believe that you're completely insane.
Okay.
I live right outside of Chicago, okay? I'm a truck driver. I'm there every day.
Yeah.
Explain to me how, in a city with the strictest gun control laws in the country, they have the highest murder rate.
Because they have one of the highest rates of inequality.
And that's something else. You guys always...
You know, Dan, maybe you haven't been listening to the program, and obviously you haven't been listening to me for a very long time. I am not saying that guns are the reason why this happened. I'm saying that we have a cultural disease in this country, and the thing is driving it is, by and large, inequality. You are 19 and a half times, 1,900% more likely to be killed in a mass shooting in the United States than in any other country in the world that has a similar income to the United States, a comparable country. Why is that? Because we are wildly more unequal in this country. We have more poor and more rich and fewer in the middle class than all those other countries. If you look at the 38 OECD nations, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the richest countries in the world, you look at those 38 countries, you put them on a scatter graph, you're going to find the United States is an outlier, way up at the top in terms of inequality and way up at the top in terms of violence. And when you look at the countries that are less unequal, that are more equal, where there are not as many billionaires and there are not as many rich people and there's a much larger middle class, because they have 90% tax rates on the top earners, and their corporations are paying 30, 40, 50% in some cases of the cost of government, like we did in this country in the 1950s under Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, like we did in the 1960s with Republican President Richard Nixon in the 60s and 70s. If you look at those countries, you will see that they have 19 times less homicide rates than we do. I'm saying we've got a cultural sickness. The guns, in my opinion, people wanting to arm up is the same symptom of that sickness as people wanting to watch Fox News, people wanting to have the hell scared out of them, people wanting to listen to right-wing talk radio and be told who to be afraid of. It's really, really simple. When you have massive inequality in a society, social cohesion, what's called social cohesion, breaks down. That's called the ability of people to trust other people. And the simple study on this that was done, and it's been repeated over 50 times now, in states in the United States, is that when you go into the most unequal states, states like Mississippi, where you've got some very rich people and a fair number of very rich people, a fair number of very poor people, and not a lot of middle class, you've got a high level of inequality, and you say, do you trust other people, or do you think that the average person trusts other people? 35 to 40% will say no. You go into a state that has relatively low inequality, a state like Oregon or Vermont, where you don't have as many rich people and you don't have as many poor people and you got a lot more people in the middle class, and you just ask that simple question. Do you think that the average person trusts other people or doesn't trust other people? 85 to 90% of people will say, yes, I think that we trust other people, or I trust other people. Only 10 to 15% of people will say they're distrustful. And out of that comes mental illness, comes obesity, comes homicide rates. I mean, all of this stuff. And the research is in, Dan. This is irrefutable. And out of that comes, damn, I better get a gun because I can't trust people. And then you got a gun around and, I'm feeling kind of depressed. I think I'll blow my head out and my brains out. And thus you have higher rates of suicide with guns, or, hey, you know, that guy looked at me the wrong way, I think I'll shoot up his car. You have higher rates of homicide with guns. And I'm done with my rant,
Dan. What is your definition of inequality, Tom?
Inequality, there's a coefficient called the Gini coefficient, and I encourage you to go to DuckDuckGo and type in G-I-N-I coefficient. And it is a mathematical relationship. You could easily, there's this very simple equation where you can say, what is the range of the spread of wealth between the very poor and the very rich in the society? And where are people distributed along that range?
Let me ask you this, Tom. Do you believe in redistribution of wealth? Do you believe that we should take money from the top earners and give it to the bottom earners to get this so-called equality?
You're asking the wrong question, Dan. The people that you're calling the top earners, I'm calling parasites. Do you think that we should take money from parasites and give it to their prey?
The job creators in this country, you're calling a parasite.
Do you think that we should take money from parasites? Okay, ExxonMobil made what, $400 billion, $40 billion in profits last quarter. They paid nothing in taxes, and they had you and me paying the taxes for the military, for the Navy, to protect their shipping lanes so that they can bring oil over to this country and refine it. And their export, you know what the number one export from this country is? It's gasoline.
They're exporting it.
Exactly. They're exporting that stuff out of this country. They pay nothing in taxes. You and I are paying for the military that keeps them alive, that allows them to do business. You and I are paying for the court system that lets them enforce their contracts. You and I are paying for the police that protect their buildings. You and I are paying for the fire departments that protect their buildings. You don't think those people are parasites?
No, I honestly don't believe that they're parasites, because they are who drives this economy. Maybe not the oil industry. But
that
so
is total bull, Dan. The people who drive the economy are the people who buy things.
Okay, but let's say...
If you buy things, Dan, if you Dan, let me ask you a real simple question. Do you spend roughly 100% of your paycheck every year?
No, not 100% of it. No.
Okay, well, most Americans do. And those are the people who are the job creators. The people who spend about 100% of their paycheck are the job creators, because they're injecting demand into the economy. They're buying things, and then entrepreneurs like me come along and say, hey, I can make something to fill that demand. And they start businesses, and that's what drives an economy. And the people like Mitt Romney who say, oh, yeah, I made $220 million last year, and I put $160 million of it in the Swiss bank account, those people are the parasites. They're not job creators. They are parasites in our society, Dan. So, like I said, you're asking the wrong question. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I get so worked up, I thought I was 20 seconds deeper into that break than I was. Yeah, we'll be back for more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday here. 46 minutes past.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbrook for video production, to our webmasters Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager Ron Hartenbaum, everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, CRN Network, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everybody at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It is really, truly, and genuinely appreciated. Larry in New Orleans, Louisiana. Hey, Larry, you had some thoughts on bottlenecks?
Yes. Hi, Tom. Long-time listener, third-time caller. The VenusProject.com is a depiction of a possible post-bottleneck society, and we do need a new system where human worth is intrinsic, you know, not necessarily based just on labor. The problems that our society face are on a parabolic rise, you know, inequality, homelessness, hunger, global warming, population, mass extinction events, even Noah says we might even be extinct within three generations. The mass shootings, of course, is just another symptom of societal breakdown. This is the society that produces these individuals, you know, 20 times as much as the rest of the world. And the thing is that oligarchic disaster capitalism will not solve the problems that it causes. You know, just as Einstein says, problems cannot be solved with the same mentality that created them. Right. Capitalism sows the seeds of its own destruction. This is the end game and the last throes of an outdated dysfunctional system based on the deadly sin and mental illness we call greed, a.k.a. Wetico.
Yeah.
The good news and the bad news is that technology, as you were just mentioning, is also on a parabolic rise. If you watch Nova Science now, they're coming out with these mind-controlled robots that can do pretty much anything, and robots like Baxter that you can teach just by showing it what you want it to do. And a lot of course, manufacturers and even restaurant owners are really interested in that. $30,000, you could replace a worker. It would pay for itself in 1 year, maybe two. And so do you see a Star Trek-like timeline coming to fruition as labor becomes obsolete and technology frees us to follow our genuine pursuits to solve the problems we face, like global warming and cancer and those kind of things, in a post-capitalistic world where there's not these conflicts of interest?
No. Sorry to be so monosyllabic there, but I think that let's look at technology for a minute. We discovered or invented fire. You know, we figured out how to handle fire. Apparently, we figured out how to handle fire around 60,000 years ago. And it produced a radical change, not just in human societies, but in human ecosystems and environments. And we did a lot of damage to ourselves and our environment before we figured out how to appropriately handle fire. I mean, multiple generations. We discovered, how to make metals, you know, the Iron Age, the Bronze Age. You just go through these technological, we got oil out of the ground, I mean, in a big way in the mid-1800s, in the 19th century. The cotton gin, actually the steam engine and the cotton gin that followed it in the early 19th century, major technological revolutions that many would suggest had a lot more to do with the Civil War than you know, just the battle over slavery. In fact, that it was, you know, technology was changing our society. So what I see is that at every major technological turning point in human history, one that, you know, where the technology is so deep and profound that it deeply alters human society, what comes along with that is a period of chaos and disaster, for lack of a better word. It's disaster for some, and it's wonderful for others. But a period of massive social instability, and so it's like you've got to go through that to get to the other side and look back and say, "Damn, shouldn't have done that." And so here's how we do it now with that technology. Am I making sense?
Well, the thing of it is, though, is that technology is on a parabolic curve. It's not.
Yeah, but see, I don't see it as a curve. I see it. You know, I'm with Stephen Jay Gould. I see it as a series of bottlenecks, as eruptive. You know, it's a sawtooth. It's a vertical line. I'll give you that, or maybe even a parabolic line. But there's a sawtooth pattern embedded in it, where there are these eruptions and these crashes, and
perhaps we could smooth that out, you know, in economics. I mean, there's ways to do that.
That's where it flies in the face of human nature. Somebody called earlier and said, well, isn't it human nature to be greedy and try to acquire everything? And I said, no, I don't think that that's our nature. I think our nature is to be egalitarian. Look at families. Look at children playing together. You know, look at how small societies are organized. They're always egalitarian. But, you know, similarly, I think it's human nature to learn from our mistakes. And when we have new technology, you know, we have to burn our fingers before we learn how to be very careful with fire. Somebody had to grab that ember.
The network hive mind of the internet, though, is changing us, and I think that
it is.
You know, we're able to see across borders now, and you know, it's
but that may or may not be a good thing. You know, that is also atomizing us. Increasingly, individuals are less connected with the other human beings around them, and more connected with people all over the planet in ways that are quite different from that fundamental connection to the local human beings. And as a consequence of that, our society, I think, is becoming more fragile. I think that there's tremendous resilience in societies where everybody is well connected to each other, and community is at the core of things. Larry, thank you for the call. And I'm sorry we're out of time. Coming up tomorrow, or coming up Monday on the Tom Hartman program, all the latest news and information from the weekend, including the latest on this horrible shooting in Connecticut, the fiscal cliff negotiations and whatnot. Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get active, show up. You know, go to movetoamend.org. Go to pdamerica.org. Participate. Tag You're It. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.